Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by eatdrinkindy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink Indy. Welcome to You Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we have looked back through the past year to bring back some segments that seem particularly timely for this weekend, when we see the 7th annual Dig In, a Taste of Indiana Food Festival, and when we also see Indy Food Swappers hitting its 5th year. So we'll hear from Chef Tyler Harold, Executive Chef of Napoli's Pizzeria and Public Green's Urban Kitchen, as he tells us about working with local farmers. And we'll also be in the kitchen for a cook this segment with Tyler as well. We'll also hear about a new artisan food business when we talk with Troy Reed and George Turquette of Pig's Tail Charcuterie. And we'll find out exactly what a food swap is when we talk with Indy Food Swappers founder Suzanne Krowiak. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Well, here we are at the end of August, and it may feel like the end of summer to you, but I'm looking at it as the beginning of the fall food fest season. And we are starting off this very tasty season with Sunday's Dig In, a Taste of Indiana, a massive food fest in Military Park that spotlights local chefs, restaurants, and farmers. One local chef who will be there is Tyler Harold, Executive Chef at Napoli's Pizzeria and Public Green's Urban Kitchen. Tyler works very closely throughout the year with local farmers, and he fills us in on what a chef does to help keep those local ingredients on the menu.
I love it all, but you sort of, you know, the greens can only go so far. I mean, you know, like, yeah, it's kale and spinach and arugula and chard and, you know, but the first time you actually get, like, a radish, you know, an actual, like, something that's not just a leaf, you're like, okay.
Something solid and round and red, for heaven's sakes. It's red, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, that's when it's like, okay, now, you know, we're kind of back to, you know, back to the fun stuff.
How does that inspire you as far as your food and the dishes you create?
I mean, it's a million percent, 100%. You know, all the menus I do are seasonal. I think you know, not only do you know, people always ask, or, you know, people ask about my cooking style or whatever, and, you know, a lot of times I'll just let, you know, I sort of tend to think that, you know, I let the ingredients just shine for themselves. And I think, you know, when you start with good ingredients, it doesn't take much. You know, it doesn't take a lot of sauces and crazy spices. I also think, you know, for me, cooking seasonally, you know, it does a service to, you know, the farmers and the other people that are, you know, that are working hard to bring us this stuff.
Now, you work with lots of farmers, probably, and maybe more so than most other chefs.
Yep.
What's that like, and how does that influence how you cook?
It all boils down to communication. You know, it's a lot of communication back and forth between myself and them. You know, at the very beginning, you know, meetings in the winter months about, you know, what to grow, how to grow it, you know, how much to grow it, you know, what can they sort of count on me or us to buy, you know, to grow that kind of stuff. And, you know, then once you sort of get into it, it's just a lot of back and forth communication. We had, you know, just already Monday, Silverthorne, Nate Parks sent me a text and said, hey, I've got spinach, arugula, radishes. I said, okay. Went a couple hours, talked, you know, decide what I wanted. I said, okay, bring me the radishes. A little bit later, he texted me and said, actually, I went out and checked on the radishes. because of the wind on Saturday, it blew the tops off the hoop houses. So he basically lost all the radishes. So, I mean, it's a lot of that sort of thing, you know, weather and bugs and God knows whatever else, deer coming and eating heads of lettuce and you know, whatever else.
So you have to, you know, adjust, you know, so you're probably constantly adjusting what you're thinking about.
Exactly. And you know, I adjust with them and they adjust with me. If we get, you know, if I get a catering, you know, that pops up and I'm like, okay, well now we need 75 spinach salads. Like, okay, hey, I told you earlier, like I wanted 10 pounds. Now I need 15 pounds. You know, can you do that? Or can you make that happen? And that, you know, it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of, you know, not just picking up the phone and calling a produce company that you can call until 12 o'clock at night, and then they show up the next day with this perfect box of whatever, and here you go. Actually, it's not always perfect, but it's in a box, at least.
So that must be a lot of extra work for you, just as you create each menu.
Not even so much, even more so, not just a menu, but just a day-to-day. And I mean, to me, I don't know if that's cliche to say, but I mean, I think it's worth it. I think it's, I talk to a lot of farmers. I talk to a lot of different, you know, sort of people who ask about this and ask, like, well, why, you know, how do you do it, or why do you do it, or what's the, you know, and I think, you know, it really boils down to two things. One, you know, because of the support from Martha and her never wavering on price, you know, to her, she wants the best possible products we can get. So I have that luxury to be able to do that, and also the buying power of 10 restaurants. And to me, it's a lot about the personal relationships that you develop with those farmers, and knowing their names and their kids' names and their pets' names and their children's names and their background, and, you know, sort of, and salespeople are the same way, don't get me wrong, you know, but it makes it more real when you sort of know them and have been to their farm and seen how they do it. And, you know, they pull up in a beat up truck and, you know, they still have their overalls on or whatever, you know, you sort of, you know, I guess, I probably shouldn't say this out loud, but, like, we work really long hours in the restaurant industry, and it's you're always on your feet, and it's hard, and it's hot, and it's sweaty, and it's nasty sometimes, and farming is a lot alike, you know, so you sort of relate to them.
Well, sure, so there's a, you know, a kinship there, you know, and I'm sure, you know, because you're taking their products that they have, you know, cared for all along the way, and then you're doing something wonderful with them, so that must be a nice thing too.
It totally is, and that's something that I sort of, when I get new cooks, I will sort of, it's sort of my little like circle of life thing, you know, I want them to know that, you know, this starts way back in, you know, November or December, you know, there's a meeting, and then we talk about what we're going to get, and then, you know, they have to order seeds, and then they have to get the seeds, and then they have to plant the seeds, and then they have to transplant the seeds, and then they have to weed the seeds and water the seeds, and the weather has to all be perfect, and the deer have to not come in there, and the raccoons don't have to come in there, and then they have to pick it, and then they have to wash it, and then they have to box it, and then I have to text them and say what I want, and they have to text me, I got it, then they drive it to us, then we get it. And
so that's a process.
It's a huge process, and I want every single person that works for us to know that every time that you maybe forget about something and it goes bad, or every time that we get a box of tomatoes and you just kind of throw it, you know, you don't store it right, you don't store it correctly, and we lose something, you didn't just lose a tomato or whatever. Think about all the hours and the work and the time that went into that, whatever it may be.
We've been talking with Chef Tyler Harold of Napoli's Pizzeria and Public Greens Urban Kitchen. Stay with us for more from Tyler here on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are are back here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio with one of Indy's busiest chefs, Tyler Harold, executive chef at Napoli's Pizzeria and Public Greens Urban Kitchen. We've been talking with Tyler about working closely with local farmers to ensure fresh ingredients for the restaurant, and now he takes on our Cook This Challenge. Back in the spring, I brought fresh sausages from Goose the Market and followed along as Tyler created a dish right on the spot.
I obviously always think or try to think seasonal. You know, they always say, like, what grows together goes together. So, you know, there's a reason why tomatoes and basil go together and apples and butternut squash and, you know, all that fun stuff. So today we have ramps and potatoes. So I'm thinking obviously something springy. So maybe some peas and some asparagus, maybe some leeks, maybe even throw in some rhubarb, raw rhubarb for some crunch and some, you know, acidity.
What kind of, influences are you thinking beyond spring? Is the, you're thinking a, you know, a certain type of cuisine or a certain type of spice or any kind of flavor profile that's coming to mind already?
I really wish we had some. So, oh, you know, let me look in the herb bin here. So yeah, and as far as like cuisines go, probably nothing too like out there. To me, this seems pretty American, for lack of a better way to say it. American, you know, it's not too, like, I don't really want to take it in any sort of international or ethnic route. So maybe just, I would really love some tarragon, but we don't have any. Or maybe some chervil, but we don't have any. So dill is probably going to be what I'm going to go with. Maybe some mint, you know, the sort of starchy potatoes, you know, obviously the ramps are the allium sort of family. So yeah, and I think, not to sound cliche, but since we're at Public Greens, I'll probably make a salad. That's kind of what we have, you know, the most of, or at least sort of what lends itself best here.
So what direction are we going in?
So, well, it's still going to be sort of like a salad, but it's going to be warm, more like a warm, like, grain bowl or salad or something like that. Maybe something you could eat for breakfast, you'd eat for lunch, you'd eat for dinner, probably any or all of the above. So I'm going to start. I'm just going to throw these on the grill real quick. Get some grill marks, get some char, get some of that grill flavor.
So what do you have here all set up?
Cool. So we've got just some peas, some leeks, some kale, some black barley, some asparagus, and some rhubarb. Then I've got a little bit of dill and parsley over here. So I'm just going to take this.
A dish, when you start to see a dish in your head, where do you start?
Good question. Probably with, like, you know, you sort of go with one ingredient or you go with one, I generally go maybe from one ingredient and kind of branch out off of there. So, like, if we're going to do, like, Brussels sprout, then you sort of start with that main ingredient or vegetable or protein or whatever it may be, and then you sort of just kind of branch out from there and go, okay, well, what's going to play well with this?
Well, I was wondering about the rhubarb. You know, most people, you know, if you say rhubarb, they're going to think pie, maybe,
yeah.
You know, and not as an ingredient to eat.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, obviously I think it's about, you know, anytime you're making a dish or anytime I'm making a dish, I think anybody, any chef would say, you know, it's about flavor and textures and balancing things out and, you know, salty and sweet and bitter and acid and fat and, you know, all those sort of things that you sort of have to have that balance. You know, you don't want something that's, you know, like when we do a salad, we don't want a bunch of, you know, soft thing. You know, you need crunch and you need, you need all those sort of things intermingling. to do that. And I especially now this time of year, I think rhubarb, there's nothing like it. I mean, there's nothing that really has that sort of flavor, that sort of soury, crunchy, sweet, you know. So I'm like, why not?
Now, what's the grain that you've got again?
So that's black barley.
So what are you doing now?
So basically, I'm going to do sort of a warm, like a warm grain bowl salad type thing. And then we're going to, so basically I'm going to saute up the vegetables, add the grain. We'll add the fresh herbs at the end. We'll toss it all together, throw it in a bowl. We'll slap a Sunny Up egg on top and call it good.
What do you have there?
Leeks. So these are just some diced up leeks. The rhubarb. We'll go ahead and start the egg. I did the leeks first, sort of as kind of like a, you know, like you would an onion or a garlic, and then I'm sort of just going with the hardest, the crunchiest stuff next. Do a little kale. We'll throw in our black barley. I'm actually gonna put in a little water. Peas. I'm gonna grab our herbs.
Tell me what you're looking for, what you taste for, that sort of thing.
Just tasting it, see how it needs, you know, see if it needs more salt, see if it needs more acid, see if it needs more fat, etc. I think we're good on acidity. I'm gonna add a little bit more salt because I think it needs it. I also think we are going to finish it. The rhubarb definitely adds some sourness, some astringency. So to cut that, I'm gonna add everybody's favorite thing and favorite ingredient,
butter.
So we're gonna throw a knob of butter in there, and then we'll just kind of give this a stir. The butter will help with richness and fat. I think this with, you know, the sausage probably doesn't have a ton of fat because of the potato. So we'll walk over here and we go with our fresh herbs.
Okay, it is really smelling good right now.
Yeah, that's a good time. So we'll just plate it up here. Looks like spring, I think, yeah.
We'll throw some nuts on there for crunch.
These are just some walnuts. And then we'll cap it off. And that's it.
All right, now, sort of talk me through it again. Tell me what you put together and how it all ended up.
So so basically we started with the potato and ramp sausage, sort of as the, you know, what to play off of. Thought spring, you know, what can we do to sort of play off the spring flavors in the ramps. Basically went with a lot of spring vegetables. We sauteed up some leeks. We threw some rhubarb in there to give it kind of shake things up a little bit, give it a little bit of a tang, give it some crunch. We added some kale, added some asparagus, sort of sauteed up all those things first. They're the most, you know, they need the most time sauteing, softening up, so to speak. We added in our grain, which was, this was black barley. Got that to where we needed to be, seasoned it with salt and pepper, added a touch of water, kind of loosened things up a little bit. Tasted it, needed a little bit more fat, added in a little bit of butter to give it richness, to give it fat. Finish it off with the fresh herbs at the very end, kind of keep that flavor intact. Put it down, put a little, just some chopped walnuts on top for some crunch. Finish it off with a Sunny Up egg. So we have a sort of a vegetable grain bowl, so to speak, with an egg on top, maybe for breakfast or for lunch or for dinner. Or
I think it looks good for just about anything. Yeah. It's beautiful.
Whenever, whenever you're in the mood for those flavors.
We've been talking with Chef Tyler Harold of Napoli's Pizzeria and Public Green's Urban Kitchen in Indianapolis. You can try an heirloom tomato gazpacho salad from Chef Tyler at Sunday's Dig In, A Taste of Indiana. Find out more at digindiana.org. The variety of artisan food businesses in Indiana always inspires me, and we get to talk with so many food artisans here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, like, for instance, Pig's Tail Charcuterie, a new artisan meat business from Troy Reed and George Turquette. I talked with Troy and George earlier this summer about the growing interest in cured meats and sausages and how they're creating a new business built around a love of charcuterie. Troy tells us how the idea for the business took shape.
Well, originally I started in restaurants back up in Southland, Indiana, about 15 years ago, best I can recall. From there, I stayed in restaurants. I got out for 1 year when I moved to Indianapolis, and I had an opportunity to work in the kitchen of an assisted living facility. Couldn't believe the opportunity to make any kind of foods that we wanted, so it wasn't the peel off the foil, steak in the oven sort of thing, right? And so from there, I got to experiment with all kinds of foods, and that's when I started practicing making making the salami. So that was about anywhere from 3.5-4 years ago.
And then so the idea of, you know, launching a real business around that must have started to take root.
Yes. When I originally started making it, I wasn't very happy with the end result. But I kept practicing, getting better, learning more and more about it. And as I got better than a lot of stuff that I was trying, that's when I knew that I had something and I was being encouraged by my family.
When did the idea kind of crystallize that you were going to try to open something?
Sometime around February of last year. That's when I talked to my wife. I said, you know, can I make a go at this? Give me about 3 months, see what kind of traction I can get. At the end of those 3 months, we had found a place. We began working with an architect. So I asked for 3 more months, and that became 3 more months. And now here we are at 1.5 years, still gaining traction. I think one of the funniest things that was said to me recently was that we're 90% done with 85% to go. So that's kind of how it always feels.
Now, George, tell me how you kind of came into this business. Because people might be more familiar with what you've been doing as it relates to charcuterie.
Right. So my interest in charcuterie came at charcuterie. It was culinary school 5 years ago when I started. I was working with a chef down there, and he owned a food truck called The Fiend. And I would stay after class, night class, get off at 10 o'clock, and I'd stay with him till about midnight just helping him with charcuterie, and that's where my peak interest started happening. And
now, where was that?
It was in Fort Wayne. It was at Ivy Tech Culinary, and his name was Andrew Smith, and again, he owned a Fiend food truck, and he still operates up there, and I'm pretty sure he still teaches the meat and seafood fabrication class. So at every restaurant, I kind of would, you know, let the chef know, hey, I've got this interest in charcuterie, and they'd let me kind of play around with some things here and there. So I started at the first restaurant I worked at in Fort Wayne, and then I moved to Indianapolis 3 years ago to work for Neil Brown at Pizzology, and they had a little bit of charcuterie go, and they were making their pancetta. So I kind of took over that program up at the Carmel store, and I was making their pancetta every week, just making fresh sausages, just playing around with kind of whatever I could, and it kind of evolved from more of me being excited about a hobby into an obsession, really, and I wanted to do it everywhere, and it kind of went from me being, okay, yeah, I'm a line cook, I'm a chef now, but I want to kind of transition into being a butcher and, I guess, a charcuter, salumist, whatever you want to call it. All those words sound so weird. You know, there's not many people that say, yeah, I'm a charcuter or a salumist, but I like those words. So I kind of dabbled with charcuterie in a lot of restaurants, and I started making fermented salamis when I was for restaurants when I was at Cerulean. Stuff turned out great. Stuff turned out really bad. There was a lot of mix going on there. And then I did it was an 18-month apprenticeship. I did 10 months out of that at Smoking Goose. And it was a butcher and salami apprenticeship. So it went through their entire program kind of from start to finish. So I made everything from the bacon to their fully cooked stuff. Salamis for months, and it was a great program. I loved working there. I got to learn a lot.
How was that? You know, because you know, Smoking Goose is the charcuterie that we hear about
yep.
a lot. So, well known name, well known brand, a lot of awareness. How was it?
It was awesome experience. I can't thank Molly and Chris Ely enough for everything that they were able to provide for me in that time. Like I said, I did leave after that 10 months due to a job offer at Vita, but I had the most incredible experience there. Seeing production on that scale got me even more excited than I already was. It kind of filled in the gaps of everything that I thought I knew and thought I didn't know, and kind of just was like, wow. It was really, really a eye-opening experience being there. So it stepped up my game, I feel like, a lot in terms of my product and charcuterie.
So the word charcuterie, you know, has it become common enough, do you think, that people know what it is? I mean, we are seeing it a lot on menus and that sort of thing.
Not yet. It's not where it should be. Although I would say this, when you ask somebody if they've had charcuterie, they'll say no, or what is it? And then when you tell them what it is, they say, oh, yes, of course, I've had that. They just don't know it by that name. Then the other word to use, of course, is salumi, and they think you're mispronouncing salami. So,
it happens.
But that is the truth, absolutely. So, I chose to keep the name charcuterie in the pig's tail name simply for that reason, so that when people begin to have this product, then they can associate that word charcuterie with these salamis or even the meats. So I think that that's going to help both us and people realize what this stuff is.
Is there room for the market to grow?
Well, we hope so. much like with the breweries or wineries, you know, you can take similar grapes or the exact same grapes and the terroir where they were grown and the producer produces them, you're going to get different sweetnesses and so on and so forth. Our terroir comes from the pigs and the farmers and the terroir that happens in our aging room, you know, with our mold. So we might even produce the exact same thing that Smoking Goose does, but it's going to taste different because of the way they treat theirs and the way we treat ours.
And tell me a little bit about the name, the pig's tail. How'd you come up with that?
I wish I could remember. I really do.
Didn't you say you had a bunch of names up on the wall, or was that for the logo?
No, that was just the logo itself.
That was the logo. The
logo itself was drawn 100 different ways, yes. The name pig's tail was actually probably started about 3 years ago. And I honestly don't remember. We were just throwing around some names, and it stuck. And we decided to take the twist on it, put the tail on it, so that it's kind of, you know, it's the story, the story of meat, the story of the farmer, the story of the charcuterie, and it fit. And it bothers me when companies, and not just this isn't charcuterie related, but I don't know what you do because your name doesn't say anything. And so pig's tail, it is pigs and it is charcuterie. So hopefully that homes people into what it is.
Now, tell me just a little bit about how you two came together to be working on this project.
Mm-hmm. Back in March, I broke my collarbone on a bicycle accident. And I was out of work for 6 weeks at the time. Well, 4 weeks at the time. And what happened was I was just sitting on my computer one day. My mom came to town and she was staying with me for a week. So it wouldn't take an hour for me to change a t-shirt with one arm. And I get this Facebook message from Troy, and it was just kind of like, hey, you know, I'd like to meet with you. And so I agreed, and I went out, and I met with Troy probably 2 weeks after. And we just kind of, he talked to me about Pig's Tail and the idea and everything that he had worked on, and asked me if I had any interest. And, you know, at the end of that meeting, I had a ton of interest, and I kind of went and sat on it for the night. And we just had a couple more meetings after that. It just kind of blossomed into this. All right, I'm in this now. So
Now, were you aware of George and what he had been doing, you know, with charcuterie? Because, you know, we see the Instagram pictures and stuff like that.
Yeah, George is out there. He's everywhere. When my idea for this started in February 2015, I knew that at some point I was going to need help. I couldn't do something this large without. And I don't know exactly when it was that I had actually friended him on Facebook. And I was aware of him, and I was watching the stuff that he was doing at Vita and other places. And so when the workload got to be too much and I knew that I was almost ready to turn the key on this thing, I thought, well, let's get a hold of George and see if he has an interest. And if he didn't, then I'll see if I can find somebody else. But so after that first meeting, I think it was pretty evident that it was going to happen.
We've been talking with Troy Reed and George Turquette of Pig's Tail Charcuterie. Stay with us for more on the new business here on WFYI and WFYI.org. Artisan cured meats and charcuterie like salamis and sausages and, yes, bacon have been growing in popularity recently. Indy's Smoking Goose meatery products can be found in restaurants across the country, and now another charcuterie business will soon be on the scene. Troy Reed and George Turquette of Pig's Tail Charcuterie will be bringing their products to restaurants and consumers, hopefully by later this year. Troy tells us about the challenges and complexities of launching the business.
What's the nitty-gritty of how to make it happen? You don't just say, I'm going to open a charcuterie business. How do you start that?
I'm not telling because I wouldn't suggest it to anybody. there's 1,000 other things that you can do that are much easier than this. You know, to do it all over again, boy, I don't know.
It's a lot of hours. Yeah, absolutely.
Julian, I can't even begin to think where, you know, Frank Sinatra song mistakes. I've made a few, but too few to mention. No, I've made a lot and had a lot to mention. But it's the whole process really is that it becomes a circle conflict. You can't start Project A until Project B is known, and Project B can't go. And so you're waiting on A to finish theirs and B to finish theirs and C to finish theirs, but everybody has to do it before, you know, it just gets real complicated. But you got to have an architect involved. You got to have a lot of money to wait the whole thing out. You really do. It takes a lot of work. This isn't something that you can do part time when you get home from work. It really does take a lot of work.
Well, and you have to find a location too. So now tell me a little bit about where it's going to be located.
It's at 5122 East 65th Street. It is in what's called the Sector 65. Mm-hmm. We are across the street from Beer Brewery and Movable Feast.
Right, so there's a lot happening in this little area.
Yes, yeah, it's kind of changing the face of what is here and what is becoming here. So a lot more foot traffic coming through here. And I love the location that it's between Allisonville Road and Benford. Those are good north and south thoroughfares. This little strip here, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump for us to take our product onto the highway and get it to where it needs to go, or the other way around for people to get here.
Now, as far as, you know, where the product is going to end up, it's going to be very chef-focused, right, at first?
Yeah, in the beginning, we're hoping to set up a lot of direct accounts and things with chefs here in the city. We're already working with a couple people right now, setting up some proprietary stuff, working on some test items like that. But again, a lot of our bulk business in the beginning, we're hoping, is going to be through the local chef community, as well as setting up some distribution accounts so people are able to purchase our products not only directly through us, but they can go to, you know, a distributor like Piazza or something like that and be able to purchase our product. We haven't gotten in touch with them yet or anything, but we do want to set up lines of distribution. We'd also like to be in some specialty stores, you know, Pogue's Run, Wildwood Market, places like that. Those places will definitely be on our radar to be putting our product out there and having available.
Now, about the product, these are not just your regular pigs, right? You're working with, you know, with specific breeds and specific types of animals.
Yeah. So we're working with a couple different farms. Our biggest farmer that we're working with is Matt Hayden up in Fisher Farms, Hayden Family Farms. So he's raising a cross pig, and it's actually a three-way cross, which is actually really exciting. So he's taking a Gloucestershire, Old Spot, a Berkshire, and Mangalitsa, and he's kind of put them all together over these genetics over the past couple of years, and this dude will be able to talk your ear off for 2 days about these pigs. I mean,
he's not enough memory on your farm.
No, I interviewed him. We had him. He was on the show a few weeks ago talking about the pigs and the farm and all the things that he's doing.
Yep, exactly. So you already know. He's great. We're super excited to be working with his pigs. One of the things that he said when he came out from Sonoma County is, okay, I want these pigs to be raised specifically for a charcuterie. So it was really, really exciting for us to be able to meet with him and partner up and work with him. We're also working with a couple other farmers. We're working with some large blacks. Mangalitsas and Berkshires are going to be the bulk of what all of our products are made out of.
Tell me why the type of animal is important.
So it's important for charcuterie for a couple different reasons. Obviously, we're not just cooking something to an internal temp and killing all the bacteria. You know, we've got it aging at 55 degrees. We're fermenting at another temperature. So you just want to be careful in the product selection. So the way that Matt raises his pigs is very beneficial for charcuterie, because the way that you finish a pig is very important as far as the fat goes. So fat's a big important part of any charcuterie. So if you finish a pig on like
apples and mash, right?
Exactly. Those create this beautiful hard fat. So if you finish an animal on
a corn diet or a soy diet, then your fat's much softer. It's a little more yellow. Right. It's still okay, but it's not that quality that you're going to get from the apples and the grain.
Right. Yeah.
So we get this sweetness from the apples, and you just get a whole different flavor profile in just the raw product. So you already know that if the raw product tastes so much better, then you can only expect that over time.
Right.
You're just going to develop more flavor, more aroma. It's just all around going to be just a better product. So we go through a very specific selection process of our hogs and who we want to work with. And again, you know, our philosophy and the business model of Pigstail is to only operate under whole animals only. So we don't want to be parting, you know, buying 100 pounds of shoulder from here. And you know, while down the road, you know, we might have to do that a couple times, we're going to really, really try to stay true to our philosophy of whole animals only. We're going to be able to utilize the entire pig itself, from the bones to the trotters to skin.
What do you expect some of your products will be? Do you have, you know, some signature things that you're working on, or some things that people could maybe look for down the road?
Yeah. Well, in the beginning, we're going to do a lot of salami products, because the turnaround time on those is roughly about 5 weeks. So before we start getting into things like pancetta and copa that take around 100 days or so, we want to do the salumis. We're focusing a little bit on the traditional ones, such as the Calabrese or the Finocchiona, and then we'll do a little experimentation as well. We have one that's a cacciatore, so it's in the style of the hunter. Cacciatore can be translated in the style of the hunter, but people do it differently from different regions, because it can be made from different kinds of meats. It can be made with different kinds of spices. So that kind of gives us that leeway to put our spice blend together. Mm-hmm. We've made it. It's wonderful. I can't wait for people to try it.
Any other signature things that you expect to be working on?
Yeah, we're working on, obviously everyone out there has a bacon. We're not going to focus on a fully cooked line at all. So what we want to focus on is that the dry cured stuff, the stuff that gets funky and moldy, the stuff that we really appreciate. You know, it takes more time, so not that it's going to be better, but it's going to be better. but we are working on a bacon. So this bacon is going to be different than your traditional bacon, what you get cured, hot smoked, and sliced, and then it's ready for packaging. Ours is going to be a little bit different of a process, where it does get cured, but we're also going to cold smoke it and then hang it. So ours will get aged. It's got a little bit of a funk on the outside of it. So what that does is it takes out all the water moisture. So when you go to cook it, it doesn't shrivel up. So when you cook this giant piece of bacon, it's going to stay the same way that you cut it. So we're working on some tests right now for some bacon products. So I think that's going to be really exciting. You know, it's going to kind of blend pancetta. If pancetta were to have a baby with bacon, then I think that's going to be similar to what our bacon is going to look like. At least that's what we're hoping for. Obviously, we're still testing.
Now, can people look forward to trying some of your products soon? You're going to be out at maybe the markets?
We're permitting
right now. We're permitting right now. We're waiting to get approval for everything. We're hoping 6 weeks we can start being at some farmers markets. We've got our eye on three of them, obviously, with just me and Troy. We can't be two people at three markets. It would be cool, but we only have four arms between the two of us. So we're looking at Garfield Park, Carmel, and Broad Ripple right now. The Carmel market would be great because we would partner up, obviously, with Matt Hayden. He's got a booth up in Carmel, so it'd be kind of cool. You know, you go up to the Carmel market, you see the raw, fresh product right there, and then right next to that is the dry-aged charcuterie products, which would be really cool. But yeah, six weeks is our estimate. Like, it could take longer, and it could be shorter.
We've been talking with Troy Reed and George Turquette of Pigstail Charcuterie. You can find out more at pigstail.com or follow their progress on Facebook. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, and I have to tell you what I'm doing today. I'm headed to a food swap. I've got some jars of spicy fire and ice refrigerator pickles all ready, and I'm going to go swap them for something else at today's Indy Food Swappers event. And today marks the 5th anniversary for our local food swap. Indy Food Swappers founder Suzanne Krowiak tells us what a food swap is all about.
Well, a food swap is remarkably like its name in that a group of people show up and we swap food. We swap things we like to make. The only guidelines are that it's either homemade, homegrown, or foraged, but foraging is not a wild pastime, and some people do it in Indianapolis, but we haven't really seen that at our food swaps. Mostly what we see are people who have made things themselves, anything from, you know, pickles, jams, to breads, their favorite cookie recipe, teas, sourdough starters. Honestly, from Chex Mix to you name it, and it's probably been at one of our food swaps.
I think that's interesting because I came to the very first one, yes. and I had chocolate chip cookies, but I felt like, well, you know, this is more than a cookie exchange, but that might be an idea that people might understand. You know, how you bring cookies to a cookie exchange and you go home with something. And the food swap is like kind of like that, but so much more.
It's exactly like that, and that you bring. And also the way cookie swaps traditionally work is you take home what you bring. So if you bring, you know, 6 dozen cookies, you leave with 6 dozen cookies, but different ones than the ones you made yourself. And that's also the way the food swap works. So it's a one-to-one swap, and you take home what you bring. So if you go, you know, one of the early food swaps, a woman, she just brought a pie. She brought one pie, and she left with something. Now, I think she probably wouldn't do that. We have had other people who do that, and they will maybe make a pie, and they'll package 3 really good slices of pie and swap that so they can break it up and get more for their pie buck, so to speak. So it is that, where you go and you swap what you have. So one of the most frequently asked questions I have is, well, how much do I bring to a food swap? And my answer really is just to tell them, well, it's a one-to-one swap, so you'll bring whatever you want to take home. And so people generally bring anywhere from 6 things to swap up to maybe 12 or 18 or more. I would say the average is between 8 and 10. And by that I mean not 8 to 10 different things, although certainly you can do that. But let's say you are making cookies and that's what you're swapping. You would package up your cookies maybe 4 cookies in a bag or some sort of, people get, some people put them in Ziplocs, some people get very creative where it looks like it could be sold in a really high-end food, the artisan shop. So then you would take maybe 8 to 10 packages of cookies, and that's what you would swap.
Tell me how that works, how you get to actually swap your thing for somebody else's.
So what we do is everybody who arrives, and we do our swaps at City Market in downtown Indianapolis, and everybody gets a little table, and they set up what they brought. It is a ticketed event, so you can't just show up and participate. We have a limited, we cap it at 35 people. Generally, the tickets become available 2.5 to 3 weeks before the swap and tend to go quickly. And so you have to have a ticket to participate. So you come with your ticket and with your items, set up on a table, a small table, and then everybody gets what's called a bid sheet. And it's not a silent auction, but that's the imagery I use often to explain it to people, where it's a sheet of paper. So everybody sets all everything up. They set out their, what we call bid sheets, this one piece of paper. And then everybody walks around and takes a look at what else is available, what's interesting to them. And so then what you do is, so if I go and I try someone's shortbread cookies, and I'm the one who brought some jars of jam, then I would write down, let's say, Jolene, you brought your, if I recall, salted chocolate chip cookies, right, which were very good. And I want to trade my jar of, you know, ground cherry jam for a package of your cookies, then I would write my name on your bid sheet and I would write what I'm offering to swap. So I would write my name, Suzanne, ground cherry jam. So we spend, you know, 20 minutes to half an hour doing this, where people are walking around, seeing what's available, and then writing down their name on these bid sheets for things that they're interested in swapping. And then after everybody's had a chance to look and see who's interested in their items, we literally almost have a signal, you know, ladies and gentlemen, start your swapping. And then it's difficult to describe if you're not there, and everyone just kind of picks up their things and walks around and swaps. And so as I said, the bid sheets are really a starting point. So just because someone's written their name down, you know, it may be that, you know, on your way to them, you know, other people stopped you and that looked great. And so it's what I tell people is, there may be people that don't want to swap with you. Maybe they have, you know, they don't like chocolate, so they're not interested in the salted chopped cookies. But so maybe, you know, you maybe don't like ground cherry jam. So I wanted your cookies, but you're not so interested in my jam. So I just like, oh, that's cool. There's someone behind you who has something equally delicious. So I try to tell people not to take it personally, because you aren't obligated to swap with people. It is a barter. It's like, do you like what I have? Great. I like what you have. Let's trade. So one thing I do is really encourage people to not take it personally. If someone doesn't want to swap, it could be a food allergy, food sensitivity, just a food, whatever. Chocolate isn't their thing. Nuts aren't their thing. But people always leave happy.
We've been talking with Suzanne Krowiak of Indie Food Swappers. For more information on upcoming food swaps, go to IndieFoodSwappers.com. As I mentioned earlier in today's show, I am headed to a food swap today. As Indie Food Swappers founder Suzanne Krowiak told us, a food swap is kind of like a holiday cookie exchange, where you bring a dozen cookies and you take home a dozen different cookies. Only, you don't really know what you'll be bringing home at a food swap. You never can tell what people will bring and what you'll be able to swap. But like I said, I have some spicy refrigerator pickles in mind to take, but I've also been busy with a half a bushel of peaches that I brought back from Michigan earlier this week. I always intend to buy Michigan peaches because I do vacation up there, but it always seems like I'm there at the wrong time. I managed to get in on the blueberries and the popular Traverse City cherries when I'm up north in July, but by the time we head back for a fall trip, usually in late September, I've missed the peaches. Well, this year, a trip to our family's cottage in the UP coincided happily with peach season. So, on our drive back home the other day, we made a stop at a roadside orchard that we've always driven by but never managed to stop at. Probably because it's invariably nighttime when we're driving north, and if we're driving south on the way home, we're all tired and cranky and just want to get back. But this year it was on my agenda to stop at Uncle John's Cider Mill near St. John's, Michigan, and see if we could find some peaches to bring back. We arrived just before closing time and got back on the road pretty quickly with half a bushel of fresh peaches. Now, that was really just a few days ago, which means that I still have the better part of two sacks of peaches just waiting to become pies or cobblers or something. So far, I've made peach salsa, which I have to say was a success. Once we got home, I hit our farmer's market Wednesday and loaded up on tomatoes and onions and jalapenos. And I've decided that Indiana tomatoes and Michigan peaches are a terrific match. And now I'm thinking about what else I can do with that combination. Like, say, maybe a peach barbecue sauce. Or maybe a spicy peach jam for my Labor Day hamburgers on the grill. And of course, I really will make a peach pie. Or maybe a cobbler, like my mom would have made. And what I really better do is hurry up and get some in the freezer. Because I just know that those peaches would taste great a few months from now. And that they'd remind me of a late summer road trip to Michigan in the middle of an Indiana winter. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. Thanks so much for tuning in to our show this week, and thanks also to our guests. Tyler Harold, executive chef at Napoli's Pizzeria and Public Green's Urban Kitchen. Troy Reed and George Turquette of Pig's Tail Charcuterie. And Suzanne Krowiak of Indie Food Swappers. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, Indy.